All right, if you take out your message outline for today, we are finishing up our series, six-week series called The Love Dare. In a moment, I want you to hear a real-life story of somebody who lived this, what we're going to be talking about today. But I want to do a quick review first. If you have missed most of The Love Dare, let me encourage you to go on our website, and you can download the message, listen to them online. It is the best material I know of. And of experience to help me with this element of trying to love difficult people. Thank you, Scott. We talked about eros. Eros is what the Greeks called love. That's what most of us Americans assume love is. High feelings. If the feelings are there, we're in love. If the feelings are not there, maybe we're not in love. That's only one part of what love is. It's really kindergarten of love. If I live on feelings, then eventually I'm going to run into this brick wall. What about me? What about my needs? What about my feelings? Who meets my needs? You are going to find yourself irritable, frustrated, angry at the very people or person you claim to love. Then we looked at agape. This is a very different kind of love. This is the kindergarten of love. This is sort of like graduate school love. And God is trying to get us to build on this and to add and to become really what he calls a loving person, not that kind of love. Then we looked at two ideas that revolutionized our lives. This thing of what are my needs and what are my desires. And that what we typically do is we define what our needs are, and we say that my spouse is required to meet my needs, when in reality, from God's point of view, my needs are really desires that people can meet or they cannot meet. But in reality, only God can meet my deepest needs. When we confuse these two issues in our hearts, we are going to make a mess of things. Today we're going to talk about the costliest kind of love. It's what the Bible calls grace. And I want you to hear in just a moment from Dave. Before we do, Greg, come up. Greg has been working on this painting for us. You remember when he first started out, all we had was an easel, a blank canvas. Didn't even have the canvas here. But over time, he has been painting this scene from down at Back Bay, little by little, building. He's building something out of the mind of the artist. Now, what do we have? What's been added since last time?
Well, I don't know if you can really see it from back there. I was having a hard time seeing it, but I put some grass in over here. I've added the shadows from these bushes and the blue inside the palm tree and the dead palm fronds I put in, and then the pampas grass here I put in. So that's like technically what I put in, and it to me it really has a real sense of the light down there. So. And also, as I walk up and get closer to it, there's all these little surprises that pop up, which are kind of fun to me. And hopefully, if you guys are ever down there walking or riding or whatever down there, and you come on this scene, you'll look up and you'll be a connection. You'll realize that someone else was there.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Now, I'm down there quite a bit, two or three times a week, riding on this. If you are not down there, you may be looking at these yellow lines and think, how come they're not in the center of that road there? Explain to us about the yellow lines there.
This is the area that the pedestrians and cyclists are supposed to be in. This is where the cars are supposed to be in. But that yellow line's pretty useless because they're all over the place, right?
Yes, they are. Yes. Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. So.
If you were to sell that painting in an art show, what would you hope to get for that painting?
I don't know, thousands.
Okay. And about how many? It's a fair answer. About how many hours would you say total did you put into that painting, including just even when you weren't with the easel, you were thinking about the painting, thinking about the picture? Kind of your total.
Oh, gosh, maybe 50 or 60 from the first times that I was down there that I saw this thing and thought it was interesting, and then took some pictures and put the pictures together and you know, came up with a composition that I thought worked right, and then the painting of it.
Okay. So. Now, we are going to have this out in the foyer for about a month. Thank you, Greg.
You bet.
One of the things I... This picture is a picture of agape love. That just sort of, eros just sort of happens. Agape doesn't just happen in our lives. It's something we build. It's something we put together. It's something we invest in somebody. We are trying to give to somebody. We are working. There is effort, intentionality in what we're trying to do. Over time, what we're trying to do is build something of beauty and wonder. But that is a hard thing to do. Dave, come on up. This is a good friend of mine, Dave Quesada, and I want him to tell you a true story where this kind of love was very costly.
All right. I don't know if you guys know, but Ellie's dad's been a Southern Baptist pastor for about 42 years, and I believe the year was 1996, and I was serving, lucky enough to serve as the youth pastor back then, and there was this member, his name was Loop, and he had just started, his whole family had gone to the church. It was about 25 people of our church was made up of this family, and Loop had gotten married about 3 or 4 years before I met him, and he had, his wife was 22 years old, and they had a 2-year-old son. And I believe that her family had a history of cancer. Leukemia, I think, for the boys, and Hodgkin for the girls. Well, she had contracted Hodgkin's disease, and she had stage 4 Hodgkin's disease, and she was in bad shape. He had come into the church, and I remember us praying for them and their family, but I never really met them before. All the 25 family members would raise on Wednesday night prayer night, and we'd be in continuous prayer for this lady, Maribel, and for Loop. Well, Loop and Maribel finally came to the church, and they had come before, but I just never really noticed them before. But she was looked like she was in really bad shape, probably 80 pounds, and just very sickly, coughing a lot, and she was in some trouble. And Loop, trying to make a little bit more money, he had got an opportunity to work at Target as a floor supervisor, some Target in Santa Ana. I don't remember which one, or Costa Mesa Target, somewhere on the Santa Ana border. So he left his job, and he had a couple of months in between where he was, I don't know, laying brick or something with his family. Well, he had made a big mistake because he had stopped his insurance, and he went to go start Target. And he thought, well, great, I'm going to make a little bit more money, and Target's a bigger corporation. They'll help me more. Well, Target ended up saying, sorry, that's a pre-existing condition. There's no way we're going to cover you and your dying wife. No possible way are we going to cover that. So Loop went back to his old work, and they said, no, you left. You're off of our insurance books. So Loop was in a really hard spot. And lucky enough, the oncologist at Hoag Hospital who had been treating them, Dr. Sheehy, he went ahead and out of his own pocket was carrying them for a few months while Loop was trying to figure out what he was going to do in order to get the treatment he needed. Well, all was for naught. There was no answer for Loop. There was no way that she was going to be covered by any program or anything. And Loop and his family had been here in the United States for years, but she was still getting her green card. She was in the citizenship process trying to get her green card. So she was stuck with the United States, and she was stuck with Mexico. They said, no way are we going to help you and fork out that money. So long story short, Maribel, what she really needed, she came to the church. She's in bad shape. We were praying for her, and everybody started asking questions about what we could do to help her. And I think the family had just pretty much given up. They said, you know, she's been dying for the last 3 years. Her family has a history of it. This is her fate. There's just no way we're going to be able to help her. And she's sitting there with 103, 104 fever in church with a blanket on. And we're all crying and praying for her. And it dawned on the church leadership team, Ellie and I, the pastor's family, you know what? There's going to have to be something that we could do to help her. We can't just sit here and watch her die and They had already started. They had already asked us to plan for the funeral and where it was going to be and how the service was going to be and everything. And she's sitting there with a little two-year-old baby. She's 21 years old. Her husband's 22. And we decided, you know what? Let's see what we can do about raising some money for her and seeing if we can pay for the medical treatment ourselves. So we went down and talked to Dr. Sheehy. Dr. Sheehy said, of course, well, you guys are insane. This cancer, you can't raise money to take care of the cancer expenses to take care of somebody who has stage 4 Hodgkin's disease. So we asked him, well, what's the best hospital around? And I don't think we were too knowledgeable, at least back then in 1996, about cancer and so on. So he said, well, there's the City of Hope is the best place, but you guys are never going to be able to get in there and so on. I'll treat you a little bit the best I can here. But you know what? She has stage 4 cancer and she has a history of it. Why don't you just go ahead and prepare for death? There's nothing really you're going to do. It's inevitable. Well, at that point, the church just felt so much love for Maribel and for her family. We actually, I don't know if it was love, as we just felt so sorry for her. And we didn't want her to just go out without a fight. And then she felt so, she was appreciative of everybody, but you could tell that she felt really unloved. Like, she just didn't have a place. She didn't have a place in this insurance and that insurance and this hospital and her family. She couldn't go back to her roots in Mexico. She couldn't stay here in the United States. She couldn't go anywhere. And it just broke everybody's heart that she didn't have a place and nobody could really help her. And the only thing that was stopping her from being treated was money. And long story short, the whole church, we had a church service very much like this, about this number of people. And we all decided that we were going to do everything we can and give everything we can to try to raise money. So we went down to the City of Hope. We asked them what would it take to get her into the City of Hope and to be treated. She had a couple of doctors there. I don't remember his name. I think it was Dr. Chen, some oncologist, and said, you know what? We see the blood tests and the work from Dr. Sheehy and the lab reports. She's actually eligible for a bone marrow transplant. But there's no way that without insurance that you guys are going to be able to, for us to have us perform it. And if you filled out the paperwork for a free one and petitioned for it pro bono, it's a 2.5-year waiting list. And she honestly, Ellie, I think she was like, has 105 every night. She was staying at our house. And she was, I think she was coughing blood, and it was just a big disaster. So she needed immediate help. And it was horrible. I never heard a cough like that before, ever in my life. It was a deep cough, went through the walls. If you put a pillow over your head, you couldn't block it out. It was that deep of a cough. And then it would end with her going to the restroom and spitting up blood in the sink. And it was just the saddest story ever. And anyway, long story short, the whole church got together. And we started giving everything we had, all of our money, all of our savings account, everything in our checking account. It wasn't just some picture or somebody far away in Africa or some distant land. It was somebody who was a sister or a cousin or an aunt of 25 members of the church, somebody who was right there in front of us, and somebody who wasn't coming up here asking on her own, save me, help me. She was being humble and just was thanking everybody. So somebody got the bright idea after we started raising money and we started maxing out our credit cards, everybody trying to chip in to get to $120,000 because that was the amount that we needed to pay for the treatment at the City of Hope. So I'm telling you, in 7 days, the church raised $53,000. And then in another five, then when somebody called the news, I don't know who, somebody called Channel 7 or Channel 11, all of a sudden, we had church service every single day. On the fourth or fifth day, after we hit 53,000, the news van rolled up. It was a Channel 7. And when Channel 7 heard, Channel 5 came. When Channel 5 came, Channel 2 came. Everybody was there. All the news reporters, they were saying, what the heck is going on that you guys are raising money up to help somebody who has cancer? Pretty soon, we started getting checks from everywhere in the United States, from different countries. And I think in 21 days, we raised $117,000. We went down to the City of Hope, and with a $50,000 check, cash, we got her admitted into the City of Hope, and she began her treatment. They started the chemotherapy and everything preparing for a bone marrow transplant. Okay. the other good part. Ready? As she was being treated and she started getting better and started gaining weight, and she was supposed to have died within a month, she's now on her 7th month of life, getting healthier and healthier, and she went into remission. There was a balance of about $59,000 that we had raised, and we had paid for an apartment for 1 year so that they could live there while Luke would take care of her and he didn't have to go to work. And we had paid for the apartment, a nice little condo, you know, with the whole works, furnished apartment. We paid for that for a year. Luke was taking care of her. The family, I don't know how families do this or people do this, but they kept track that there was a balance of money, okay? And it was set aside for ultimately her funeral and to take care of her while she went through her bone marrow transplant and her treatment and the different bills that were being paid at the City of Hope. The family came up with an idea and said, you know what? We had a meeting with us, and we were wondering what it was about, and we sat down and talked to them. We honestly thought it was to thank us, and they instead, it was a meeting with the senior pastor, myself, the pastor's family, and a couple members of their family, and they said, you know what? What we really think that should be done next with Maribel, and we were listening, they said, we really think that you guys should give us the remaining balance so that we can open up a restaurant. And our family can have a restaurant. And if we have a restaurant, then we could be financially stable and we can thrive on our own. And we don't need you guys anymore. And the senior pastor explained to them, that's not the reason why people donated from around the world and the United States to raise money to have you guys open a restaurant. The reason why they gave to the 501c nonprofit corporation was to save your niece or your granddaughter's life. And the family was becoming really distraught. Finally, one of them stood up and said, that's our money. We want it right now. We want you to go to the church office and come out with a check and give us the balance of our money. And anyway, it broke everybody's heart. It was a big tragedy. And the family, instead of being able to get sense tucked into them, ended up getting so angry that they ended up leaving the church. And then told one the members that were in the meeting told the other members that David and Pastor Pablo really wanted to keep the money for themselves and that they're thieves and they're liars, and all of them left. And they not only did the 25 family members leave, they convinced another 15, 20 family church members that we were thieves and liars. And, you know, them. We always knew David was a liar, and we always knew Senior Pastor was a thief. And we had our suspicions before, but this confirms it. So another 15 members left. So we lost about 45, 50 members in that. And we don't regret helping Maribel at all, not even for a second. But we certainly would have loved to have been part of her life in her last years. She ended up dying 3 years later. And her one dream was to see her little 2-year-old son go to kindergarten. And she was able to see him go into kindergarten. And about 6 months later, she ended up coming out of remission and passing away. But anyway, I hope that was the point you wanted, Seth. Sad stories. You like that? Is everybody sad enough for you?
It was.
Okay, good. At the saddest point, Seth smiled, so I knew I did good.
That was a church up in the high desert. What I want to talk today about is the high cost of love. Love is a costly thing, and the kind of love we're going to talk about today is the most costly. There was a pastor who was in New York City walking downtown, and he was waiting for a light, and he noticed that the woman next to him was also waiting for the light. They were going to cross the street, and she couldn't have been 18 years old. She had a 2-year-old daughter that she was carrying, and he noticed that she was likely a prostitute, and he engaged her in conversation, and within a short amount of time, she opened up and told her story. She'd gotten pregnant. Her boyfriend had left, of course, and left her to raise the daughter, and she didn't have a really place to go. She left, went to New York City. She had become a prostitute to try to pay her bills and to support her habit, but that wasn't enough. And then finally, but she did discover that there were some men that were willing to pay a whole lot more money if she prostituted her 2-year-old daughter. And the pastor, as the story was being untold, was just dumbfounded by this, and he asked her, he said, have you thought about coming to church? And she looked at him like, church? That's the last place I'd go. He said, how come? She said, because I already feel so guilty enough now, why would I want to go to a place that's going to make me feel more guilty? Now, that's sadly how often our non-Christian world thinks of folks like us. That we're sort of the moral police, and if they open up and share something of their story, they're going to get hammered. Now, that's not just true out in the non-Christian world. You may have noticed as a Christian that oftentimes, sadly, that's how we treat each other. Even though we know that we should love the Lord our God with all of our heart and soul and mind and strength. Let's go to the next verse, Robert. Love our neighbors and ourselves. Even though we say that, and we know that's most important, and we want that to be true in our lives, oftentimes there is something else that sort of wins out. When we were first married, most of you know, our first 3 months were rough. We had a tough time. She did a lot better than I did, frankly, because she was a lot more mature as a Christian than I was. But I remember we had been back from our honeymoon less than a week, and I came home from work, and she had made dinner. We sat down for dinner, and we got done, and we put our stuff in the kitchen. She was cleaning up the kitchen, and a little bit later, you know, we in the other room, and I happened to go back into the kitchen to get something, and I looked in the sink, and the sink wasn't clean as I thought about clean. And so I took out a product called Babbo. I don't even know, do they make Babbo anymore? Kind of like Comet. So I pulled out this thing from underneath, and I was Babboing the sink. And Mindy walked in while I was doing this, and she said, "What are you doing?" Simply an information question. And this is what I said to her. I said, "The sink is not clean until it's been Babboed." I don't remember anything being malicious about that. I remember at the time, 26 years old, that's sort of what I had learned growing up. And here I was, and I had no idea what I had just said to my wife. One of the stupid things that I got irritated about was her shoes. Now, I do not wear women's shoes. Never have, nor do I presently. But I have heard stories. I have heard stories from you ladies about wearing these unbelievable shoes, and the last thing you want to do when you come home is keep those shoes on. I understand that. Now I understand that. Back then, it was hard for me to catch because she would come home, and she would plop down, and wherever she plopped down, the first thing that happened was those shoes would come off. And in the first few months of our marriage, those shoes just happened to sort of camp out there. They just kind of built a home, and there they abided for however long until someone, usually moi, happened to pick them up and put them in the closet. Now, even though my head told me this is stupid, this is so piddly and goofy, why am I so irritated about these stupid shoes? I remember one day being so just beside myself with just frustration about the shoes. She was not home. I walked into the bedroom, and she had probably the biggest high heels that she owned sitting in the middle of the floor. I had rolled an ankle one night at 3 in the morning going to the bathroom over such shoes. I reached down and picked up those shoes as a young husband. Our closet door was open, and there's a little break between hanging clothes. I picked up these high heel shoes, and with all the fury I could muster, hurled those two spiked high heel shoes into the back of the closet, hoping that those spikes would lodge themselves in the back wall, never to be seen again. I was going to put the clothes back up so they couldn't be seen. What was that all about? Now, I can say to you that loving God and loving people is the most important thing in my life. That's probably what I've said. And I would have said that my intention is to love my wife like Christ loved the church. I had just promised her this weeks before. So what was all this about? Well, unbeknownst to me at the time, though I said that love was the most important thing, There were some other things later on I realized were really driving me, unbeknownst to me. There were some hidden drivers, and I've got three of them here. The first is, I know better. Now, it's not that I sat down and said, I know better on some of these things than Mindy. But my statement about the sink is not clean until it's been baboed. Unbeknownst to me was really a statement that was saying to myself, in this area, I am an expert. I have something to say. I know something here. Now, I could not have told you that at the time. But in hindsight, I know better is a common driver in my life. A second driver was, I deserve better. I deserve better. And this is seen in the high heel incident, the shoes being hurled into the closet with such fury. Because what I would have known at the time and have said to myself is, I'm not asking for a whole lot. Just a little consideration. A little thoughtfulness. It's not like I'm asking you to put my shoes away. These are the kinds of things that were running through my mind. I'm just asking you to put away your shoes. Not a big deal. Why? What's the driver? Because I deserve better. And the third driver that was alive in me, unfortunately, was I'm determined to feel good about me. Now, at the time I'm standing in the sink with the thing of Babbo in my hand and a wash rag, what I'm really saying in that moment is, I hope you feel loved by me, but when push comes to shove, I'm going to make sure that in this given moment, I feel better about me than you do. It's not that I want her to feel bad. It's just that there was another driver in me that was alive and at work that wanted to make sure at this moment I was going to feel good about me. You with me on this? You see this? Now, those drivers have been alive in me for a long time. They did not just pop up in marriage, nor have they disappeared just by seeing them and recognizing them. Now, the Bible says that this should not come as a surprise to us. And here are some great verses. We're just going to skip through these very quickly. If you have played the fool and exalted yourself, for example, standing in the kitchen and saying the sink is not clean until it's been baboed. That's what he's saying here. If you have played the fool, which I had, and exalted yourself, which I did, or if you have planned evil, clap your hand over your mouth. I didn't do the last part of that verse. Next verse. Here God is speaking to Satan, and he says, your heart became proud on account of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to the earth. I made a spectacle of you before kings. In other words, the same drivers are at work in Satan as were driving me. My heart became proud on account of my beauty, or on account of something, not beauty for me, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. Same driver. Next verse. This is of the king. When the king's heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne, stripped of his glory. The same thing. I know better. I deserve better. And I'm determined to feel good about me. Those drivers are alive in the king. 2 Timothy 3, Paul says, people will be lovers of themselves. Tick. There's one box I checked. Lovers of money, not at the moment. Boastful, yes, standing there in the kitchen with the babo. That's two. Proud, yes, three. Abusive, yes, four. Disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, five, unholy, six. I hit six out of eight in that one incident. Next verse. They close up their callous hearts, their mouths speak with arrogance. Proverbs 21:4. Haughty eyes and a proud heart, the lamp of the wicked, are sin. Now, Mindy and I had a talk about every 3 weeks. She would drag out sort of what was going on inside of me. She asked great questions, and I would reluctantly express, you know, my irritation or my frustration or my annoyance, and it seemed so petty, and why was I like that? And we'd have a discussion, and she would promise to do better, and then at the end of that, I would feel a whole lot better. And then the cycle would start all over again within about a week, where I had this invisible pad of paper, And I had this invisible sharpened pencil. And whenever I would notice something, it seemed like my eyes took note of that. Almost this criticalness. Now, it's not that I ever said anything to her. But my mind was working and writing down things. And we'd have another talk 3 weeks later, and at 9 weeks, and at 12 weeks, we finally sat down again for the same discussion, and she said to me, "Seth, I know it may not seem like it to you, but I want you to know I really am trying to change some of these things." And I kind of nodded, and then she said, "But I don't think you're really going to be at peace unless you accept me just the way I am, even if I never change." And the first thing that struck me when she said that was that, wow, you know, some of these things may not change. It'll be a long time. Second thing that struck me was for the first time in 3 months, I put two and two together and realized that I had been slowly giving her death by 1,000 razor cuts every day. Though I don't think, could be wrong, that she ever heard those words from me. It's doubtless there was not a day that went by that every day, instead of feeling loved and accepted and delighted in, she felt that sort of like, oh. You know how your teens do to you. Okay. And then what struck me was is that just 3 months prior to this, I had stood eyeball to eyeball with this woman and promised her that I would love her just as she is, love her like Christ loved the church. I would sacrifice myself. I even promised in front of her, her mom, dad, brothers, our friends and family, that I would accept her just as she was. And suddenly I realized I had completely fallen flat on my face and had utterly failed at this. All of a sudden, instead of feeling noble all these times because I was doing my part for 3 months, all of a sudden I felt very, very ugly and very, very exposed. I was humiliated at myself. I was absolutely mortified. And I sat there and looked at her and I thought, the first time I thought, I wonder if she'll leave me. And I thought, no, I know her. She's not going to leave me. Though if she did, she would have cause. And then I thought about what she just said to me. I don't think you're going to have peace unless you accept me just the way I am. And then I thought, she's got no guarantees that's going to happen either. I was completely dumbfounded. She's in tears. Now I'm in tears, absolutely humiliated. And I asked her to forgive me. And for one of the few times in my life when I felt completely self-centered, completely selfish, and I was completely exposed for her to see the ugliest part of me, she expressed kindness in the face of meanness. She gave me a taste of what the Bible calls grace. That's what I want to talk about today. Pieces of grace. What is grace? What will break the drivers running wild in my heart? There's only one thing that will break those drivers that I need to look better and I want to seem better. I want the people to think I'm a pretty sharp guy. All those drivers are at work. I deserve better. I know better. Only one thing will break that, and that's grace. The question is, what is grace? Grace is a concept that is very foreign in our culture. When I grew up, we said grace before we pray. That was just kind of a prayer. What is grace? Well, if you think of, to try to get there, grace is, maybe we can start with mercy. Mercy is not getting what I deserve. If you were in high school, you'd worked for 4 years to try to get a 4.0, or now you can get higher than that with all the extra hard classes. Let's say your senior year, you were studying for a final exam. You got desperate because you thought you were not going to do well on that. And your teacher caught you cheating. You've worked for 3.5 years to try to get into some great college, say Stanford. And you know friends who had 4.0s and they didn't get into Stanford. Some of our kids had 4.0s and didn't get into, not Gatchel kids, but our church kids. you know that if your teacher turns you into the administration, you could not just be suspended, you could be expelled. You would be labeled cheater, and it's likely that your dream of getting into Stanford would be gone. If the teacher does not turn you in, the teacher has been merciful. You did not get the punishment that you had coming to you, that you had deserved. Now, that's mercy. Grace builds on top of mercy. Grace is, I'm getting something good, even though I've done something bad. To try to define grace is really a hard thing. But one of the things Jesus did is he gave some stories that illustrate it, because it's really more wondrous than definition. In Luke 15, suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she light a lamp, sweep the house, search carefully until she finds it? When she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." What does this have to do with grace? He tells this story in the presence of two groups of people. One is Pharisees, Jewish religious leaders, who were just like me the first 3 months of marriage, walking around with their piece of paper and their invisible pencil, taking notes of how people were not measuring up and what they ought to be doing instead. They were irritated because he was hanging out with the, in their mind, the lowest of the low, tax collectors and prostitutes. Now he tells these guys a story about God. And what he says is, in the same way that this woman who loses one coin, she doesn't just say, no big deal. I get paid next Wednesday, I'll have more coins, I'll get paid the next week. If I need more money, I can work overtime. That's not her approach to that lost coin. Her approach is she turns that house upside down until she finds that coin. Now what he's saying to the Pharisees is, that's something of how God is, who God is. He values people. And he will turn your house upside down in order to find people. The second thing is God searches for us. He's not just sitting there hoping we might come. He's not just up there rocking on his front porch. But he is on a rescue mission to try to find the lost one of us. Now you hear that story, and you may just sort of yawn. Good story. 10 coins, lost one. Still have 9, go find the one. You will find that story rather boring if your idea of yourself is, I'm a pretty good guy. That's good. You know, God values us. I can see that. I'm a pretty good guy. I'm not an axe murderer. God values us. And does he search for me? Well, yeah, I guess so. That's cool. However, if I see myself instead of that, if I see myself as the guy who said to his bride of 10 days, the sink is not clean until it's babbled. And if I see myself as the man who did the equivalent of that, probably many times, every day for 90 days, where she was experiencing death by 1,000 little razor cuts, and I am finally exposed for the self-centered moron that I am. Then when I read this story, I'm going to say, he values me? Why would he do that? Not based on what I did, not to her, not just in 3 months, and search for me. I can see how God can search for people, but I doubt I'm on that search list. I'd have some questions. He tells another story, just the kind I need to hear. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep, loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. He calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there'll be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Now, it's one thing for me to say, okay, God values people and he searches for people, but I don't think he's going to come searching for me, not in light of what I did to this lady just for those 3 months. But here, this story says, au contraire. Yes, you are the one, Seth, in that story. There are 99 others, and just because you've gone off somewhere thinking noble thoughts about yourself and being completely self-centered, God values you. Me. And he values you. Then he tells the story of the prodigal son. The prodigal son is, we usually think of it as the prodigal son story. I think of it as the brokenhearted father story. There was a teenage boy, roughly, probably in his late teens, and he came to his father and said something along this line. You know, Father, you were raised on this farm, this ranch, and my older brother's raised here. But down deep, I don't want to live my life on here milking cows. I'm a city boy. I want to go to the city. And the thing I don't want to do is live most of my adult life here waiting for you to die until I can get my inheritance and then go enjoy my life in the city. It seems far more reasonable to me to get my inheritance now, give it to me now. I'm going to go to the city and live my life now. Imagine your children coming to you with that request. The father gives the inheritance. The son goes off. He squanders everything until he's finally penniless. The economy goes south. The only job he can find is in the pigsty, slopping pigs, which is a horrible job for a Jewish boy. And he finally comes to the end of himself, and he's making his way back home. Now, when I think about this story, as Jesus was telling it, there are two pictures that I am just dumbfounded by about God's love. The first is God's love aches. It is a costly love. It's the kind of love you guys experienced in your story trying to help Maribel and that family. It is sometimes costly to love. And here we have a brokenhearted father. Verse 20. The son got up, went to his father. While he was still a long way off, and the picture is he's way off on the horizon making his way back, and the picture of something of the father on the porch, maybe in his rocking chair, more in our day, looking out across the landscape, hoping his son will appear. When his father saw him, he was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Now, the father has had a broken heart for his son. He has been wounded by his son. It is a costly thing. And yet there's something else more important as he moves across the landscape than just the drivers of his life or the drivers in my life. And I think when he threw his arms around his son and stopped him mid-confession, I suspect the son was absolutely dumbfounded. One reason why is that the father didn't scold him. If I had been the father, I would have probably thrown my arms around him and then said, what were you thinking? Do you know what you did to your mother? Well, I suppose you've hit the wall and you've come back with nothing based on how you look. You look like you're a mess. Look like you slept in days. Well, you look like you've been with the pigs. All right, well, you can come back, but you're going to have to earn your way back in our home. That's what I would have said. When I was growing up in church, I remember sort of having that view of God. I thought of it as the reluctant forgiver. You know, that I would come to God and ask his forgiveness for something, and God would say yes. But after I've come back to him 5 or 10 or 20 times over the same thing, I sort of had this mental picture in my mind that said of God going, are you back again for the same thing? How many times are we going to go over this? I had this mental picture of God just sort of rolling his eyes and just kind of being disgusted. The father could have done that, but there's nothing about that in the story. In fact, the story continues. The father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe, put it on him. Put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. The son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. They began to celebrate. This is the part of the story that must have dumbfounded the Pharisees. Is that the second picture of God's love is he is filled with delight. The picture is the father sort of jumping up and down and kind of running around his son and just kind of celebrating like, wow. That's a whole different picture than the picture I grew up thinking about God, particularly as he thought about me. But that's the picture. Now, when it comes to the father could have given the lecture. The lecture would have been driven primarily out of, I know better. Your mother and I deserve better. And even at this moment, we are determined to feel better about ourselves even than you. Those were not drivers in the father's response. There was something else that was a driver, and it was to give his son a taste of grace. undeserved favor. The last piece of grace, these are all sort of like jewels on a necklace, but the greatest piece of grace, the greatest little bauble on the chain, is something else. A number of years ago, I was in Colorado for a counseling course, and about midweek, it was about 9 o'clock at night, and Larry Crabb was finishing talking, and I was, all of a sudden, I sort of daydreamed about a story that had happened in our home just a few days before. I think it was Saturday morning. I'm at home. I'm reading the paper in our garden room a couple houses ago, and my kids, my two older kids, were 6 and 4 at the time, eating up at the bar, having breakfast, I think. And I'm sitting here like this, and unbeknownst to me, all of a sudden I hear the unmistakable sound of those little plastic cups being tipped over, and you know how it kind of bounces on the wood, you know, kind of click, 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 click. And then I heard the unmistakable sound of milk splattering on the tile floor. And as I'm sort of daydreaming about this, all of a sudden I am daydreaming about this as if not through my eyes as it's happening, but as if I was a video camera up here in the corner watching Seth and watching Brittany and Cole, ages 6 and 4. And what the camera caught was me at the paper, like this, reading, hearing the clicking of the plastic cup falling over, click, 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 and the milk splattering within a second on the floor. And what the camera saw was something like this. Now, the camera also caught my 6-year-old daughter and 4-year-old son going like this. And from the camera's view, I could see terror on their faces. And from the camera's view, I could see a glare coming out from behind each eye like a laser. And this is not like death by a thousand cuts. This was like I had taken a broadsword and gone, whoo, whoo. Now, back to the videotape was rolling again. Brittany, my oldest, hops down. She runs around the counter, gets a paper towel, comes back, cleans up all the milk, takes the cup, I don't know who spilled it, takes the milk, fills the thing back up, goes back, puts the milk away, comes back, sits up on the counter. Not a word is said. I didn't yell, didn't scream, didn't say anything. No words at all. And as I'm now not daydreaming about the story, but thinking about the story, I'm thinking, why was I so angry about that? And to make a long story short, I think what that story represented to me at the moment was, I want to look good, and when kids do stuff like this, they make you look bad. I was a driver. I was mortified by this. I thought, you know, Seth, one day you want your children to come to you with anything. Drugs, sex, kinds of things they're going to face. And all of a sudden I realized you're going to be the last person they come to, because what you're teaching them is they can't even come to you over spilled milk. Something as stupid as that. I got up, walked back to my place, got on the phone, called home, got Brittany and Cole on the phone. I said to them, you remember last week, told the story? They said, yeah. I said, when Daddy put his paper down, what did you see on his face? And they both said, on separate phones, separate rooms, oh, you were really mad. I was mortified. I said, Brittany and Cole, what I did was wrong. Would you forgive your dad? They say, oh, yeah. I think they were happy they weren't in trouble. And I said, I do not ever, ever want to do that again, not one time. So I'm giving you permission. If you ever, ever see me look at you like that again, I want you to tell me. Okay, Daddy, yeah, we will. Yeah, we will. Now, I experienced grace over the telephone lines. That has a chance to break the driver inside. Isaiah says, he grew up before him like a tender shoot, meaning the Messiah, like a root out of the ground. He had no beauty or majesty. And then jump down to verse 4. He took our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Verse 5, he was pierced for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. In other words, as you look at the cross of Christ, and as I look at the cross of Christ, when I stood there and said to my bride all of 12 days or so, the sink is not clean until it's babbled. And the little razor cuts that ended up being affected because of that statement. What God did is he took the whole of that mess of me standing there and sort of scooped it up, including the razor blades that were used, and said, I'm going to put it on my son's shoulders here on the cross. And that time, Seth, when you took those high heels of your bride and hurled them with fury into the back of that closet. I'm going to pick up those shoes. I'm going to pick you up and the mess that you are and the self-centered drivers alive in you, and I'm going to put those on his shoulders as well. And when you sat in your home and with your six-year-old daughter and four-year-old son glared at them like laser beams, I'm going to pick you up, newspaper and all, your eyeballs and your silence and that glare, and I'm going to put that on his shoulders as well. When I see that somebody else took the punishment that was due me upon himself, that's grace. And only grace has the power to break those ugly drivers in each one of us. Let's pray together. Richard, if you would come up and get ready. Lance, we are going to run long today. That's okay. Father, as we take communion, we enter into a time of remembering grace. That your Son took upon his own shoulders every amount of punishment that was due us, from the things we would consider big to the things we would consider small. But all of them were very costly to you. This kind of love is costly. It's the kind of love that gives grace in the face of kindness. It gives kindness in the face of meanness and self-centeredness. And it's the kind of love that you and I are called to give to the people in our lives. It's impossible to do without experiencing it. But we have a chance to taste it at the foot of the cross. Lord, help us to get a clear view of grace, the costly price you paid because you love us. In Jesus' name, amen.